This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
We find that there is a vast difference in the attitude of a man with a gun in his hand and that of one without a gun in his hand. When a man doesn't have a gun in his hand, or a woman for the matter, he or she tries harder to use his or her mind, her sense of compassion and her intelligence to work out a solution.
That's Aung San Suu Kyi talking about the power of nonviolence. Suu Kyi won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991, and she's the voice of opposition to the military dictatorship that's ruled the country of Myanmar since 1962. But for most of the past two decades, her voice has been silenced. She's been in and out of house arrest, and she started serving her most recent sentence in 2003. The group Amnesty International has long advocated for Suu Kyi's release, which is expected to happen tomorrow. Also tomorrow, Amnesty will celebrate its 50th anniversary here in Boston at its Northeast Regional Conference. Josh Rubenstein is the Northeast Regional Director for Amnesty, where he's worked for the past 35 years. Josh, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
And in a few minutes, we're going to speak to a former prisoner of conscience in Turkey who now lives in Massachusetts, teaches in Massachusetts. But Josh, before we do, let's talk about Amnesty's work, and specifically Amnesty's work based in the Northeast.
Yes.
You've headed this group for 35 years.
Yes.
Can you give us a sense of what the Northeast Regional Group in particular tries to do, especially when it comes to freeing political prisoners around
right.
the world?
Right. Well, our job in the regional office is to work with our members throughout New England, New York, and New Jersey. We have many chapters in high schools and colleges and in the broader community, and we assign these groups cases to work on, like the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, who's assigned to all of our groups here in the Northeast. He's such a high-profile case. So we've held regular vigils in front of the Myanmar Mission in New York City. We're writing letters. We marked her birthday this spring with all kinds of events and birthday cakes and things like that, just to let the government know she is not forgotten. Now, she is probably the most famous prisoner in the world today. So a lot of our effort is on behalf of prisoners who are forgotten. If we didn't write on their behalf, no one would know about them. So Amnesty chapters throughout the Northeast region, and for that matter, throughout the world, are assigned these cases. We're writing letters. We're circulating petitions. We try to be in touch with the families of these prisoners. And this is part of our fundamental campaigning in defense of human rights to gain the release of prisoners of conscience.
Josh Rubenstein of Amnesty International, we just heard that wonderful line by Aung San Suu Kyi saying that when you don't have a gun in your hand, you're forced to find more creative ways to find solutions. I'm wondering how effective you think your efforts are, because obviously you're doing these nonviolent efforts, but you're also dealing with military dictators, totalitarian leaders that have very strong arm tactics that do have guns in their hands.
Well, that's true. And obviously our work is obviously difficult. However, I do have the perspective of 35 years. Back in the mid-70s, when I started with Amnesty, first as a volunteer, and then I was hired as an organizer, we were contending with disappearances and political murders throughout the southern cone of Latin America, in Chile and Argentina and Brazil and Paraguay and Uruguay. Today, these countries are functioning democracies. They have their problems. They have their challenges. But there's a very dramatic improvement in the political life of these countries.
Do you think Amnesty International has played a role in that improvement?
Well, I think we played a role in documenting the abuses and morally isolating the governments of Pinochet or the generals of Argentina when we documented thousands of disappearances. Today, the president of Brazil is a very successful, effective president, Lula da Silva, who was himself a political prisoner and was tortured in Brazil. And of course, the changes in Eastern Europe. When I started in the mid-70s, we had hundreds of cases in the former Soviet Union. We had Václav Havel, the playwright campaigning for human rights in what is now the Czech Republic. He later became the president of Czechoslovakia after the Velvet Revolution. So there are places where you have these dramatic changes for the better over decades. And of course, there are places where things are worse. Parts of Africa, the terrible violence in Sudan today, what happened in Sierra Leone, what happened in Liberia under Charles Taylor. And these places are just barely recovering from those years of violence and turmoil.
You're marking, I mentioned, your 35th year as the Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. When you look back over those 3.5 decades, what do you consider your greatest success?
Well, the most important thing is that we have sustained a level of grassroots activism in this region, that we have members who've been with us for 20 and 25 years who started as high school students. We meet their families now. This weekend, we'll have 500 or 600 of our members from throughout the region. And it's wonderful to see the commitment of these young people. And if I've contributed to that, that means a lot to me. I think in Massachusetts, we did play a role in stopping reinstatement of the death penalty. Governor Weld wanted to include reinstatement and include the juvenile death penalty for people who are 16 and 17. And we did play a role in exposing that and getting the legislature to make clear that was not going to happen.
What about disappointments? I'm sure there are some of those, too. What's your greatest disappointment?
Well,
the
most difficult thing is when we campaign for a prisoner who dies in custody. When my group started and I was a volunteer, we were assigned the case of Anatoly Marchenko, one of the most famous dissidents in the Soviet Union. At that time, we were able to help him. He did get released in the 70s. He was rearrested, and he died in Chistopol prison in December of 1986, about a year and a half into Gorbachev's administration. And this was an impetus that later led to the release of many political prisoners. But that was a terrible blow to us. I'm his biographer. I'm a friend of his family. And that was terribly upsetting to all of us. And also last year, 2 years ago, a prisoner we were working on in Libya, whose brother lives here in the Boston area, his case was assigned to us, Fatih Al-Jami, and he died in Libyan custody, interestingly enough, in Amman, Jordan. It was a very complicated case. And that was a terrible blow to us. We worked very hard to try to get him out.
Josh Rubenstein of Amnesty International. I mentioned we also have on the line with us a former prisoner of conscience in Turkey who now teaches at Clark University in Worcester. That's Taner Akçam. Taner, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
You are someone who was imprisoned and is no longer imprisoned. Could you tell us, this happened, I believe, the first time, or was there more than one jailing, or was there only one time you were imprisoned?
I was several times in prison, but last time it was the longest one. The earlier ones, basically, because of the student activities, distributing the flyers and some other issues like that, and I was in police custody for 3 days, 4 days, but last time I was arrested, and it lasted 1 year.
The first time was when you were a college student nearly 40 years ago. This was in Turkey?
Yes, it was mid of 1970s, 1975, and I was a graduate student at Middle East Technical University in Ankara. Today I'm in Turkey's capital city. The same year, 1975, I became editor-in-chief of a student journal that reported on domestic social issues, including the treatment of the Kurdish minority in Turkey. And because of my articles, I was arrested in 1976 and sentenced to 9 years in prison. Soon afterwards, I was adopted as a prisoner of conscience and by Amnesty International. And this was how I first came to know the Amnesty International.
When you were in prison, did you know that Amnesty was focused on your case?
Yes, how I couldn't. The heartfelt postcards that reached me in my dark and humid cell brought real messages of hope that I will never forget in my life. Those letters from individuals unknown to me were the light in my darkness of those days.
So it really made a giant difference to know that there was someone out there.
Amazing. I mean, you have, of course, your friends and your family and other people in Turkey supporting your case because it was a very clear case of freedom of speech. But on top of it, knowing that there are also other people, regardless their ethnic origins or nationalities, supporting you in solidarity with you. This is an amazing support and very important.
And Taner Akçam, at some point you actually were imprisoned and escaped. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it is a story for itself, and one can make an excellent movie from it. After a year in prison, I dug a tunnel with a group of other political prisoners, and I escaped from prison and fled to Germany.
You dug a tunnel?
Yes, I mean, it is a long story, but you know, one should not think that prison in Ankara at that time, like high concrete walls and barbed wire, ours wasn't like that. I mean, it was an old horse stable with walls made of stones. And if you were strong or had help, you could pull them out. So we dug a tunnel, and it took a couple of months for us. We actually dug a tunnel from one building within the compound into the other building within the same prison compound. And in the windows of that building was looking to the street. So this is how we could escape.
Taner Akçam, at one point you had been in prison because you acknowledged the Armenian genocide.
Not for that. I learned about the Armenians and Armenian genocide when I was in Germany. This is another tragedy of Turkey. Living in Turkey as a graduate student, I had never heard that something like that had ever happened, and I even didn't know that there are Armenians living in Turkey at that time. I learned all this in Germany, and there were some criminal investigations against me in year 2004-5, later, after I started publishing on Armenian genocide.
You know, as you know, the issue of the Armenian genocide is important in the Boston area because we have a considerable Armenian population here. And as you know, Barack Obama, when he was a candidate, had vowed that he would recognize the Armenian genocide. But some people feel that he hasn't lived up to that because he doesn't actually use the word genocide. I wonder if you feel like he has lived up to his word, or how important it is that the word genocide be used.
It is crucial. It is very important. I think we should never let the denialist governments in the world to pressure other democratic governments. If a country continues to deny its own past, it is a threat for the security, it is a threat for its neighbors in the region also. It is crucial for Turkey's democratization. It is crucial for Turkey's and region's stability that Turkey acknowledges this historic wrongdoings. And I think Obama must acknowledge the genocide, use the G term, if he really wants a stable, democratic Middle East in the region.
Taner Akçam of Clark University. I want to turn back to Josh Rubenstein, the Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International, because one person who is still in prison that the Northeast Regional Chapter has focused quite a bit on is Aung San Suu Kyi.
Yes.
Why that case in particular? So many people are behind this person. Why have you made that one of your causes?
Well, in the U.S. section of Amnesty, we assign a case to each region, the Northeast, the South, the Midwest, as a way to mobilize a great deal of grassroots support. And so we assigned Aung San Suu Kyi here. Yes, she's very well known, the most famous prisoner in the world, but we still wanted to show there is grassroots support for her, not only support from other Nobel Prize winners or the New York Times and governments, and even governments in Asia that are close to Myanmar have voiced their support that she should be released. So we want to show the government there's still grassroots support for her. And so our members have been doing that. And by coincidence, she's scheduled to be released tomorrow, the day of our conference. And we'll see what happens.
Do you think that will happen?
No one really knows. There are all kinds of conflicting messages. It's possible they may say she's released, but then put such onerous restrictions on the release that she will not accept it. That happened before. So the generals have a way of being very creative about the word release.
She also would like other political prisoners released if she is.
And so would we. We believe there are more than 2,000 other political prisoners in Myanmar. The great majority, no doubt, are prisoners of conscience. They should not have been arrested or detained in the first place. They were rounded up in various demonstrations that have been held in the streets to protest one condition or another in Myanmar. And we want to see these people released as well.
Josh Rubenstein, in the 35 years that you've been Northeast Regional Director for Amnesty International, a lot of technological change. How has the rise of the Internet changed the work that you do?
Well, the first and foremost, it's easier to share information. Obviously, our reports are now online. People can go to our website, amnestyusa.org, or the website of the London office, amnesty.org. It's easy to send appeals to our members and members of the public. It's easy to be in touch with the media and send out press releases. So it's the sharing of information that's really the biggest change, I would say, and that we can alert people immediately when we know about a crisis, when we know about individual cases. But the bottom line for us is that technology doesn't change the moral dilemma we face. People are still in jail. We need to learn about them through various sources of information, from their families, from attorneys who are defending them, from people within a government who may choose to share that information with us. The technology is just a tool. It's not a magic wand.
So tomorrow at the Northeast Regional Conference, it will also be a 50th anniversary for Amnesty International.
Well, keep in mind, it's our 50th next year in 2011. So part of our conference this weekend is to prepare our members for the anniversary, to encourage them to do events beginning this December with write-a-thons, which we do every December 10th or around December 10th, that's International Human Rights Day. We'll encourage our members to be at our national convention in San Francisco next March. We'll be doing events throughout the coming year to mark our 50th anniversary.
Josh Rubenstein, what do you consider the most pressing human rights case in the world right now?
Well, that's a very difficult question. Obviously, we have extreme situations like Sudan, the violence in Darfur that people have mentioned. It's hard to pick out one case over another. You know, the fact that the U.S., and we've seen President Bush said he used torture, and no one's being held accountable. No one says that the U.S. is the most, is the worst violator. Obviously not, but it's the most important violator. And when the Bush administration, now the Obama administration, refuses to hold people accountable for using torture, what is that message to the rest of the world? That's like a green light to the real dictatorships who we know are using torture and get away with it.
So when you see your country doing that, is it personally crushing at some level?
Well, it adds another layer of dismay. It steals our determination because it's closer to home that our government, which is such a beacon of hope around the world, engages in these practices. Yes, after 9/11, after the terrible events of 9/11, the world had a consensus, you don't use torture, period. And there are no circumstances that justify the use of torture. And the U.S. always said that was the case for other countries. And now we've made an exception for ourselves. And that is a very disturbing lesson.
You had said earlier that technology doesn't change the moral dilemma. It may change the way you do your work, but the dilemma is still there. So when you look at the next 50 years ahead, to a great degree, do you look at it as more of the same work, or will the work be different in some way?
Well, it will be different in that recently Amnesty has expanded what we used to call our mandate to include social and economic rights. We used to focus really only on political and civil rights. So, for example, we now are working on maternal mortality as an issue connected to women's rights and violence against women, because the fact of maternal health is not just a public health challenge. It has a human rights dimension that governments refuse to give resources that would make a big difference in many countries, including our own, over the health of women during the time that they're pregnant, giving birth, and for the month afterwards when they are still vulnerable to various syndromes and life-threatening problems.
And Taner Akçam of Clark University, I want to put a final question to you. You, of course, as we talked about, were a former prisoner of conscience. What's your advice to people who are prisoners of conscience now?
Oh, it is a very tough one. If they can hear me, they should really, really believe and know that there are a lot of people outside and they are supporting them, and they should really keep their head up. This is the most important thing. Never give up. Never give up. This is the only way to resist the oppressors.
Taner Akçam, thank you very much for that. Taner Akçam is a professor at Clark University. He's also a former prisoner of conscience in Turkey. And we've also been talking to Josh. Thank you very much. We've also been talking to Josh Rubenstein. He's the Northeast Regional Director for Amnesty International, now in his 35th year of doing that job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amnesty International's Northeast Regional Conference happens tomorrow at Boston University's George Sherman Union, and it's open to the public. Yes. And tonight, in coordination with the conference, the Kendall Square Cinema will be screening the movie Tibet in Song. We're about to take a break. When we come back, a shark with lips and other unexpected things that one critic says you must see at the MFA's new Art of the Americas wing. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.